right. Thanks for joining another episode of Radonk on the Run podcast. I'm Brandon Mancini, your host, and honored to be joined today by Ron Giacomo, who's CEO of RCCS. And Ron, do you want to describe what RCCS stands for?
You know, it's Revenue Cycle Coding Strategies, and it's part of a family of companies that helps doctors and hospitals with coding of all outpatient specialties.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. With Radonk on the Run, I mean, it's a new podcast that just started in early 2026, and we're really just trying to shine that spotlight on radiation oncology. Obviously, everyone's in their podcast era these days, so we're kind
of... Yeah, you've been doing a good job. I've been seeing it all over the place.
Oh, I appreciate it. Absolutely. Yeah, so obviously, each and every year, I feel like billing, coding, and reimbursement comes up, specifically in the radiation oncology space as things continue to evolve. So we appreciate having your expertise with such a long track record within this space where you've seen the evolution over many years about where things were and how things have developed and so forth. So I think when we're looking in 2026, when you look at radiation oncology reimbursement specifically, what is something that really concerns you most right now? And then we'll flip to that at the end, kind of what also gives you optimism. So what concerns
you? Sure,
most
absolutely.
Most optimism.
Yeah. And I think it's a good question, Brandon, because there are some concerns, but let's not get so tangled up into that, that we lose focus of some good things that are happening as well. And, you know, right now, I think the concern is that some commercial payers have, you know, sort of said they didn't recognize some of these changes and weren't aware of some of these changes. And I think that some of that may be true, but honestly, you know, I think they're using it as an opportunity to delay payments. And we've got to get engaged. We've got to help our comrades across the U.S. because if you are in California, as an example, you know, the payment rates there for Medicaid, and although a small population, what ends up happening is if you are in a rural area and you're a radiation oncologist, you may see a significant amount of Medicaid. And so when we're talking about the whole span of the daily treatments is $38 to $43, I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking, it should be in the 390s. Range, and this is just Medicare. You know, luckily the commercials, when they do kick in, are higher, and that's how they're able to survive. But if you're already marginal at Medicare rates, and then you have Medicaid rates at, you know, a tiny fraction of that, it really, this is the first time in my career, because, you know, just to be completely honest, you know, you're out there and you're saying, you know, this year is going to be terrible for IMRT or SBRT or calculations or simulations or some component. And that component is true. But overall, radiation oncology is doing well. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, you know, this could limit access or this could close places. This is the first time in my 30 plus career where I'm actually like really concerned that some places can and might close. Right. And that's, so that is a genuine concern because, sure. You know, when you're, it's one thing to lose money on a one payer or two payers. It's another thing to lose it across the board. And that's where some of these concerns are happening.
Huh. Have we seen anything like this as far as like, maybe most or all commercial payers kind of taking advantage of some change like this?
Well, unfortunately, what ends up happening is some, so the difference between hospitals and physicians. So if a hospital, ABC healthcare system, negotiates and they're negotiating with United, Blue Cross Blue Shield, or whoever the payer is, and they're saying, we want 70% of bill charges. We want 80% of bill charges. They're insulated and they can negotiate at that component because if you're charging $1,000, it really doesn't matter that Medicare is in the 400 or 500 range because you're basing a percentage off the $1,000. Mm-hmm. Physicians, typically, there are some that are different, but the vast majority of physicians negotiate on a percentage of Medicare. So if Medicare falls, automatically commercials fall as well, because if you're getting paid 120% of Medicare and the 100% falls, well, then your 120% follows along with it. So it is, that's some of the problems that we see with physicians out there. And the general recommendation is, if you're able, pick a year, pick 2025 or 2022 or some year. And then if you're going to negotiate a percentage of Medicare, you say, I want 120% of 2022 rates. So that way you're static. And if the next year falls, you're insulated, like hospitals are insulated. Wow. That would be a recommendation if you can do that.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Good. And I mean, personally, I think not only through your awesome posts on social media, LinkedIn, et cetera, your team's posts, but just even your AMA, your Astro, ASCO, a lot of the emails on the 2026 Medicare physician fee schedule and HOPS updates specifically has kind of taken over that way. And you see it every year with any of the advocacy days and things like that, right? Everyone's going to be advocating for reimbursement or minimizing cuts for reimbursement and so forth. But what's specific to 2026 as far as changing the landscape for radiation oncology practices compared to those prior years?
Well, you know, I think that what makes 2026 a little bit different is it's been if you were to look at it from a good perspective, the good is that it sort of shocked a bunch of people who were comfortable in their lanes. And, you know, we've got some radiation oncologists who, rightly so, are focused on clinical care and really not getting into the details and the nitty-gritty of individual CPT codes or reimbursement. But it shocked the system in such a large way this year that even doctors who generally are not interested in reimbursement and don't get engaged are like, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? Educate me a little bit more. And doctors, as in general, of course, you're all you know, intelligent by nature. So if you feed them the data, it's not that they're not aware of or capable of change. They simply weren't aware. You start giving them data, you start making them aware of what needs to change. And I think that's where this year has been great. The advocacy that I've seen is like I've also never seen before. So in a positive way, we've gotten physicians who like, Rod, tell me about this. I've never really focused on this before. This is crazy. I had a doctor from Oklahoma that said, you know, I just started reading one of those posts that you did on X, and I was like, that can't be right. He's probably got a typo. And then it's like, wow, that was actually right. That's crazy. Right. I mean, I don't even know anything about this. You got to tell me what's going on here, because I got to tell my friends about it. And then they've got friends in different states and such. So I think in an advocacy way, it's great.
Yep.
I think what's going to change this year is that we've got a bigger and better chance of having ROCR, the radiation oncology case rate, move forward. I think that some of the work that you've been doing there at Banff is getting a lot of attention, radioligands and radiopharmaceuticals, not just for what's going on right now, but I've been telling folks, look, all of this is going to change the landscape. It's changing it now, but what's really going to be impactful is the next 5 to 10 years. So I think that if we get ROCR in place and we get physicians. So the other thing is we're starting to work with residency programs.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And so doctors, again, intelligent by nature, fantastic when they get out, ready to handle any clinical challenge. But in respect to radiation oncologists, I'm meeting some of the brightest brains in the world. Remember when I told you we were at ACRO, and like, Brandon, when we talk about stuff, man, you got to speak English to me, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you guys are just brilliant in that way. So, but then you start talking about the business aspects. And I think that some radiation oncologists may not be exposed to it unless they are in personal ways. So we're starting to get residents involved and talking to them about the business of radiation oncology. You've already got the clinical components down, but you need to know coming out of school and residency that If you're happy with payments, great. If you're happy with everything in your life, business-wise, good. But you don't have to wait until you're frustrated and annoyed at losing revenue to make a change. And I'm starting to see a lot of new residents starting to ask their chairs to get congressmen and senators to tour, to learn on the advocacy days what they can say and how they can say it, because now they understand, or hopefully beginning to understand, that they can influence their income for many years. And the first 10 years of a radiation oncologist's career, compounded revenue can lead to millions of dollars. And so what we are trying to do is, one of my personal goals at this stage in my career is I want the new radiation oncologists and the new practitioners, when they're mid-career, to be able to retire. And not that we want them to retire because we got a shortage and we got to keep them there. But when you go to work because you want to, not because you have to me, it creates a stress reliever. It creates all kinds of great things for radiation oncologists. That's part of the goal. Sorry to get off track, but
it's awesome. No. Yeah, I think it's huge to come back and do more formal training to the trainees, to the residents, because I'm trying to think even back, I'm about a decade out now, and I don't recall anything specific. So potentially there's small opportunities for residents to be involved with certain like clinic leadership meetings within their department and the business side to a certain degree. But to get any sort of formal training on top of clinical medicine and physics and biology, I mean, I think you're setting people up to succeed early and to understand early, in your perspective, to make sure that we're not kind of catching up or kind of learning things later that we wish we would have known kind of during that training. That's huge. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And even something like, do you know what a wealth manager is? I've met physicians who are, you know, 15 years into their career and don't have a wealth manager, and they've got somebody who helps them with stocks or gives them advice, but that's not really a wealth manager. A wealth manager will buy individual stocks and trade for you and compound your revenues. Any radiation oncologist, you know, the average radiation oncologist makes $550,000 a year and up. So with that kind of revenue, I mean, you start doing even a little compounding, it can be material. So, but wealth managers, those are some of the things that we're telling the residents early in their career. So that way, when they're, you know, mid-career, they could do anything they want to do. That's the goal.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, kind of switching gears just into the billing and coding. I think we've kind of talked broadly about Medicare in 2026 and things like that. But as far as like first line, like either whether you're talking to a resident or you're talking to a physician that has no experience in that space, what to you are the most important things that radiation oncologists themselves should understand about coding and billing? And again, even if they're not directly involved, like just the frontline things, what are those main couple of things that they should absolutely have to understand for their department to be picked?
I think that's an excellent question. And what I would recommend is, whether you're a generalist and you treat all diagnoses, or you're a specialist and perhaps you only do brachytherapy or you only do SBRT or whatever it is that you do in your practice, go and create protocols and say, for this prostate patient, for this lung patient, for this breast patient, I treat this way. So if it's IMRT, SBRT, brachytherapy, radiopharmaceutical, whatever it is, and then line up, this is what my typical, there's all of the exceptions, but this is what my typical prescription looks like. Mm-hmm. And then you put down all of the codes that go along with it. So you yourself, not that you're going to change your way of treating patients. Clinically, you're going to always do what's best for the patient. But it's important to understand that SBRT versus IMRT versus brachytherapy or radiopharmaceutical, whatever it is, this is how many times I bill. This is how much I get paid. This is my baseline Medicare. This is my Blue Cross Blue Shield and my United and my Aetna and whomever else. Because here's what ends up happening. When you start looking at that all works together and you can say, well, you know what? I didn't want to get on that peer-to-peer. I thought it was ridiculous that that a doctor, another doctor from some insurance company told me that prostate SVRT is not medically necessary. Well, that's such a ridiculous statement and a waste of my time. I'm not even going to talk to this moron. Well, that's I can understand that way of feeling, but you actually don't want to take that approach. You want to say, wait a minute, this is putting $5,000 at risk for me. This is putting $6,000 at risk for me, or whatever that number is. Mm-hmm. And then say, you know what? Forget the money. This was the right thing to do on that patient. And I'm going to go in there and I'm going to get paid for this patient. Yes, I want the money, but this is about principle. Mm-hmm. Because if that doctor does not take that time to do that, here's what happens. ABC Insurance Company says, Dr. Mancini doesn't let anything slide. He's on it. He's appealing every single patient and such. But Dr. Smith over here, who's got equal training to Dr. Mancini, he doesn't appeal, mm-hmm. or she doesn't appeal. And so we're just going to load them up with more denials. That's the way it works in the insurance company industry. They have their own analysts. So if a doctor takes the time to get on that peer-to-peer and do an appeal, you're actually reducing future appeals. If you're frustrated and you don't make the time and you don't deal with that insurance company, they see that as an easy win for them. So they load you up with even more appeals. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But that's the world we live in.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I think even looking back, even for things like PET imaging or other things that might be routine, you can kind of feel that to a certain extent where we might even see a patient here where they had an external order for a certain type of PET scan. It was denied and maybe that clinic didn't end up appealing it. And so they get to our doorstep and we need that PET scan regardless to be able to make the right assessment. And then we apply for it and it either gets approved right away or you just do a simple kind of letter of medical necessity if there was any reason that it could have gone to that extent and it goes through without a problem. So, I mean, I once read a statistic that kind of in the setting when you get denials, right? So whenever you get a denial, you have an 80% success of overruling the denial and getting everything approved, but only like 16% of people actually go forward with it. And again, this is like across the board, all different types of treatments, all different specialties, et cetera. But basically saying, to your point, right, deny, and they'd rather, if someone doesn't appeal, then that's fine. But they know they're going to actually lose the appeal a certain amount of time, 4 out of 5 times, but you're only going to have a small portion that actually go after it. So it makes
sense. That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. And you know what? On the second level appeal, it's even more so. You have a 95% chance of success on the second level of appeal, but less than 10% do that. Wow. So it's, I mean, thank you for saying that. That's exactly correct. And good for you for knowing that. The you know, we need to make sure that all radiation oncologists know that kind of stuff. And, you know, they get busy. And they're already annoyed with more paperwork and this and that. And I appreciate that so much, but it actually makes paperwork worse in an ironic kind of way. Dealt with.
No, absolutely. That kind of made me think of the whole expansion of artificial intelligence too, right? So whether that's an algorithm at the insurance level, as far as like so-and-so's name comes through and so they're going to deny because their chance of appealing is X percent. I mean, artificial intelligence seems like it's just going to blow that up even further. So how do you think so on the good and bad side of artificial intelligence, because it might also be super helpful for clinics so you're not missing codes or that you're doing something and getting credit for the work you're performing. And whether that's with compliance, denials, management, operational efficiency. But if you look 5 to 10 years specifically in radiation oncology with AI as a component of both the insurance side, but also the clinic side or your business side, how do you see that all evolving when it's said and done.
You know, it's an interesting thing. We're actually investing in AI. And my personal opinion on this is that actually radiation oncology is going to benefit from this. And here's why, is that, as you know, and every radiation oncologist listening to this knows that when you treat a patient with radiation, it's actually beneficial. It is doing good work all of the time. And so the issue is, are we appealing? Are we making it known? And when AI, it's interesting, we're looking at testing. We're incurred testing with a partner that we're looking at AI research on. And what they're doing is they're bringing up all the clinical evidence. I mean, you know, the thing is, there's clinical evidence coming out all the time. For a single radiation oncologist or a group of radiation oncologists or even an institution in radiation oncology to be aware of everything that's happening all around the country simultaneously and currently, that's a hard ask. But you start asking AI to start gathering support and then putting it in a summation type presentation, we're going, success so far for us is through the roof. Now we're just trying to make it consistent, you know, and readable and those kind of things. But in that way, because radiation oncology actually works and is beneficial, you know, some other specialties, they may struggle a little bit, but radiation oncology, I'm confident, is going to do well because radiation oncology does work.
Yeah. No, and to your point too, even on the insurance side, I feel like some of their algorithms for what they accept for certain treatments, again, old school could have been 3D conformal radiation therapy versus IMRT. Like if they only update their own algorithms or databases quarterly, twice a year, once a year, and some new modality, new indication, new FDA approval comes out, you're going to be fighting that consistently until they decide or kind of it falls into the normal update timeline for their protocols and so forth. So I think AI on their side hopefully would also support more timely adjustments of the appropriate things as new technologies emerge, new indications emerge. So it might actually create less paperwork or appeals or backlash in real time as well. So
absolutely. And the key though is to get into the appeals process and then not let it go. So to your point on the 80% followed by the 95%, and it even goes to third level appeals at 98% success. But the issue is, does someone stick with it?
Yeah.
And the, you know, the downside of that is it, you know, this isn't like a 2-week process. It's going to be 3 months and then another 6 months and then another several months after that. We actually have overturned appeals as late as 2.5 years.
Wow.
But you have to stick with it. You have to stick with it.
Yeah. And just timely from the sense that if you're deciding to do a certain type of radiation therapy approach, like you might have days to a couple of weeks, but you really don't have months most commonly. And so it's super important to be, yeah, aggressive and ask for expedited appeals, I would argue, in the appropriate setting, right? And advocate. And I think if we all do it uniformly and we do fight for what's right, I think it'll continue to support kind of a very strong specialty and a good reputation in that space too. So
I think that's a very good point too, because you're right. There are two different kinds of appeals. There's front-end appeals for did you get approved to have whatever a modality in the first place. Yeah, that has to be done quickly, and AI will help in that way from a medical necessity standpoint. Mm-hmm. The other side, even though it's a long process on the, you've already provided the patient with the service, so now you want to get paid, you can charge interest so that 2.5 years down the road is worth it ultimately. And one suggestion is, you know, which kind of might freak some doctors out and doesn't sound appealing in the least bit, but you can actually sue an insurance company. And once you, and here's the whole deal, you only sue when you know is medically necessary, you did the right thing on the patient, it's a matter of principle, you follow it through the end, you actually get attorney's fees, you get interest, you get your payment, and you can change the rules for that payer for not just you and your practice, but your state and ideally the entire country, but definitely your state. So It's worth it on a principle. There are very few radiation oncologists who have done this, but they've actually changed modality payment with payers nationally because of their success.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's great. So I think kind of as we wrap up this afternoon, really just looking, if you could give one piece of strategic advice to radiation oncology leaders preparing for the next decade, what would it be? So what's that closing remark?
Oh, wow. For the next decade.
No pressure.
Yeah. No pressure at all. First thing, find a wealth manager. Get yourself secure financially so you can do what you love and not have to perform a job. And the last thing is read the proposed rules that are coming out. We give away summaries, and anybody listening to this podcast, happy to go. Brandon knows how to get hold of me, or I think our information is going to be on there. We give away free summaries for the proposed rule and the final rule. It's so important to see what CMS is thinking about doing this year and next year, and then get engaged. Once you get engaged and you find it interesting, each year for the next decade, if you're aware of the proposed rules as they're coming out and make change, you can control your financial component and the billing collections for the next decade and help yourself to a comfortable retirement.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it very much. And I learned a lot today, and it's great to have people advocating on your side for us radiation oncologists and patients and oncology community as a whole. So thank you so much for joining us today, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode of the RadOnc on the Run podcast. Don't forget to subscribe for future episodes, and we'll see you next time.